This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Eva! Wally!
That's Wally and Eve, the two leading robots in the new animated film Wally. My guest, Andrew Stanton, wrote and directed the film. Wally is set 700 years in the future. The Earth is one big junk pile and can no longer sustain life. Thousands of people have been on an endless space cruise waiting for signs that Earth can sustain life again, which would allow them to return home. When the people left, they forgot to turn off one robot, Wally. That's an acronym for Waste Allocation Load Lifter Earth Class. Wally is a kind of cute but rusty trash compactor who is very lonely. His only friend is a cockroach, until a robot probe named Eve is sent to Earth to look for signs of life. Andrew Stanton started at Pixar Studios in 1990. Before making Wall-E, he directed and co-wrote Finding Nemo and co-wrote Toy Story, A Bug's Life, and Monsters, Inc. Andrew Stanton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
You know, most end-of-the-world or end-of-life-of-we-know-it kind of films have to do with, like, war and atomic bombs. In Wall-E, the Earth has to be abandoned by humans because it can't sustain life anymore, presumably because humans have polluted it and just treated it poorly. What made you think about that kind of environmental end-of-the-world-as-we-know-it scenario?
I went there very reluctantly. Reverse engineered my decision. It was all based on character and emotion. The conceit that got me interested in this movie was the last robot on Earth, doing its job forever, not knowing that it was a waste of time. And I thought that was the ultimate definition in futility. I completely was seduced by that.
It's like the Andrew Stanton version of Sisyphus.
Right. And so in my mind, that's what was so charming, was the last robot on Earth. And so I had to just come up with some conceit that would make that situation. So to just get that kind of a character, I was forced to come up with a scenario. And I just went with logic. I just went with, well, I wanted him to do trash, and I wanted him to be a trash compactor for basically three reasons. One, it gives him a very low status. It makes him like a little janitor, he's a little more endearing for that. Two, because I knew we'd be using what I call unconventional dialogue through the whole thing, trash is very visible. It's clear to any age that it's dirty, it's in the way, it needs to be moved out of the way, almost like a snowstorm in a city. And three, which was the biggest reason, was that it allowed him to go through the detritus and the sort of evidence of what mankind was all about. And that was huge. So then I just went backwards from that and said, well, one thing I know is I'm always buying stuff online all the time. There's a million boxes coming to my house every day between my wife and I. And I just sort of extrapolated that, what if people just did too much of consuming? It didn't really take too much brain power to sort of go with that possibility. I certainly didn't want to go with anything darker than that. So I sort of came to this environmental state without really considering the environment.
Well, it's funny. Let me just read you a couple of quotes about how political they see your film as being.
Oh, gosh.
So the first is from Frank Rich, who's a columnist in the Sunday New York Times, and he writes, "The movie seemed more realistically in touch with what troubles America this year than either the substance or the players of the political food fight beyond the multiplex's walls." And then in an online column on National Review Online called Planet Gore, Greg Polowitz writes, "I saw Wally with my 5-year-old on Saturday night. It was like a 90-minute lecture on the dangers of overconsumption, big corporations, and the destruction of the environment." Are you surprised to hear both sides of the reaction to your film?
Sadly, I'm not surprised, but I tried very hard not to have any kind of a lecture. I just went with logic of how you could be in this scenario so that I could tell this story of this lonely little robot. There's no way. I mean, this idea came literally in 1994 and slowly built up over time. There's just no way I could have been in tune with exactly the zeitgeist and the headlines of today. I mean, I'm not so much in a box that I wasn't aware that suddenly the world had changed in the last couple of years. But I didn't want to change the movie for any reason in one direction or the other out of fear. That's not how I'm going to make a story. I'm going to go with what I think is the honest, truthful way to tell this emotional story that I've been trying to tell. So sadly, it doesn't surprise me, but I can't back up either direction. I really can't.
Can you describe the landscape of Earth as you've envisioned it in WALL-E?
Well, basically, I just went with a dump. It's a big dump. And I just felt like, what if I took out all the slimy, wet, oozy aspects of it? One, it's very off-putting, and two, it's a little more difficult to execute. And there was something sadder and more forlorn about this sort of arid dump aspect, and just having stuff everywhere.
You're more rusty than oozy.
Yeah, exactly. Which I take as a compliment.
So you know. Did you go visit, like, junkyards or dumps or things like that just to get, like, a sense of what your version might look like based on what reality looks like?
Very much. I mean, that's how sexy our research was. We went to dumps.
Oh, boy.
But a lot of it's also very geeky. It's like, how exactly, we're breaking it down to just the tiniest visceral things of what makes a dump feel like a dump. And there's a lot of things that may not be obvious to people. There's always little bits of flapping paper or plastic, and almost like there's always movement of leaves in a tree. And it's things like that that you go for research to pick up. It's those little imperfect or odd details that really take it over the top. And make it feel like we've really tapped into something for any research, let alone a dump.
What about the colors that stood out in your mind after going to dumps?
Well, I geeked out at the idea of being able to do a much more monochromatic palette. That's not usually associated with animated pictures. And because there's this stigma of it being a babysitter or family fair, and it has to have every color of the rainbow in it and all that stuff, which really makes me, you know, want to go in the other direction when I hear that. I loved that just the natural setting required a monochromatic bent to it, at least in the beginning of the film. So it's dealing with lots of yellows and tans and browns. It made anything primary, like even the chipped away red circle of WALL-E's E, or the one time you finally see something real, like a plant, really stand out. And it's almost like having the restraint of using a close-up and not using it until the very right moment. And suddenly it has this huge impact when it's used.
My guest is Andrew Stanton, and he's a writer and director of the new animated film WALL-E. You know, early in The Robot, who's really a trash compactor and is the last robot on Earth, early in the film, he's just, you know, going through junk, compacting it in basically his robot stomach and making bricks out of it and just like piling up the bricks. It's just an incredibly meaningless existence. But in his home, he saves a lot of the junk and he kind of files it away. Yeah. And, you know, some of the things you have in there is a light bulb, a Rubik's Cube, old like videotapes with, you know, like cassettes. How did you decide what would be the things that WALL-E decides to save and file and keep? And I'm wondering if any of those items are from your home.
Well, I none of them directly came from my home, but animators are collectors, big time, and particularly of toys and childlike objects and stuff. So we don't have to go too far to have a lot of options or ideas. But we actually had to go through tons of objects, either verbally in meetings or drawing lots of stuff, to find things that were immediately gettable. Because, again, I don't have the luxury of dialogue to support where his head's at. You have to just get right away that, oh, if he has a spork, of course you'd be confused whether it's a fork or a spoon. And to find things that sort of fit all those requirements, it was actually pretty hard and time-consuming to get to. Where we ended up always finding stuff was just kind of going back in our memories, which isn't hard, again, for an animator to do, of what it's like to be a kid, and go, okay, I remember being either at my father's tool bench or in the kitchen and looking through the items and finding things that I had no idea what they did, and I caught it completely wrong. You know, I thought like an egg slicer was a tiny little harp. I remember thinking that my mom's eyelash curler was some kind of awful torture device. It must have hurt. and I couldn't watch her use it, you know. And so it's just trying to go back to remembering seeing the world that innocent and what kind of objects aren't intuitive. But they evoke a definition. You can't help but go, oh, I think it must do X, you know. So it was a tough assignment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Stanton, and he wrote and directed the new animated film WALL-E. He also directed Finding Nemo and was one of the writers on Toy Story and A Bug's Life, Monsters, Inc. Now, here's one of the challenges you faced in animating WALL-E. You know, WALL-E is a trash compactor, a robotic trash compactor who has, you know, like eyes and a nose and a mouth and kind of arms and stuff. So, you know, there are anthropomorphic qualities about them, but garbage trucks, like anything pertaining to trash, we really try to keep our distance. We expect it to smell. We expect it to be very unpleasant. But we have to really love WALL-E. We have to, I mean, he's our surrogate. You know, he's our lonely surrogate. So can you talk about making this robot that's all about trash and all about like rust and dirt and stuff like that, and yet you have to make him both human and warm and lovable enough for us to see him as our surrogate, as the main character, as the hero of the movie.
Yeah. I get asked this a lot, or at least versions of this question of how do you make a robot appealing, or how do you make this trash robot appealing? It's, in a weird way, it's a tough question to answer. I find it interesting that you said he had a nose and a mouth, and he doesn't.
He doesn't.
And it's funny how, and it's how much you've thrown.
I just assume he does.
It's how much you've thrown.
God, I'm looking at his picture now, and you're so right. There's no mouth there, but I kind of redrew him in my mind.
But that's more of a statement that you see him as a whole. You see him as a real person, I think. I learned once I got to college, because I came from a very small town where I was the one of few kids that could draw in class, and there weren't a lot of kids that liked the same things I did, and we were drawn to each other. And then when I finally went to college, which was a school called CalArts in Los Angeles, which actually teaches animation, one of the founders was Walt Disney, I met all these other kids of my type, and that's when I found out I was a type, that we all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things. And I can't remember never not looking at the world like that. And I think, in a weird way, I don't think about things like, oh, how do I make this appealing so that people will like it? I think it's more just through scribbling and just observing the world, finding things that already do that to you, that already elicit that from you, and just taking and capitalizing on it. WALL-E is a perfect example, for at least his face. I was at a baseball game. I missed an entire inning because somebody handed me their binoculars because we had crappy seats, which I blame on my editor. And I missed the whole inning because I turned his binoculars around and I was in the middle of trying to design WALL-E, and I just started making the eyes, you know, fold at the center hinge and go sad and then mad and then happy. And I saw an entire character with a soul in it, and it just sort of answered itself. It just sort of dropped on my lap.
So that's why you ended up giving WALL-E binocular eyes.
Yeah, he's basically a binocular on a stem. Yeah, yeah. And I didn't have any other agenda than I'm just trying to find something that feels. My big agenda was, you should see it as an appliance first, and when it moves, you can't help but convey a character in it. Because I felt that's what John Lasseter had tapped into with Luxo Jr. He had done that short just before I had come to work at Pixar. So I was just a fan and an audience.
This is a
member.
Short about a lamp.
Yeah, one of those little desk lamps that's got springs and bends, and there's nothing about it other than maybe scale where it's designed to look like a character. It just happens to be an object in life that feels like it could be a character, and he was just capitalizing on it. And I wanted that kind of purity out of any of the robots that we did, even though we had to make them up from scratch.
Talk about the rest of WALL-E's body.
Well, he was built out of sort of steps of logic. I knew I wanted him to compact trash, so we just made him a box. And this is a real geeky association, but we didn't have an art department at the time that we really started fundamentally designing him. So I had to use my few story guys and us to sort of have these days where we would just sketch ideas. And I had been to a Peter Gabriel concert in 93. 3, I think it was, where he had two stages that were connected by a rampway, and one stage was square and one stage was round. And he had separated the songs he performed on them based on what he felt was a more female song and what was a more male song. Some of those were obvious, some of those were not, more indirect. And I always was fascinated with just that primary shape of the square and the circle being associated that way. So I went that way. I said, let's go with a square with Wally, and let's go with something roundish for Eve. And so we said, well, that's perfect. We'll go with a cube. He can spit out trash. And then he's got to get everywhere. He's sort of the first wave of this cleanup task force. They're sort of like army ants. So we put treads on him so that he could get over all terrains. And I think it was honestly a couple months before the head came, the binoculars at the baseball game.
Okay, so you've described this kind of male-female split, and Eve, or should I say Eve or Eva? It sounds like Eva in the movie.
Well, he calls her Eva because he can't speak correctly. I love that he had his own electronic language and she had her own, and he's trying his best to speak like she does, but he can't get it just right. So she's Eve.
Okay. So Eve is this female robot who comes to scope out Earth to see if there are signs of life yet and if mm-hmm. Earth can be recolonized. And she, you know, Wally is this, like, you know, rusted tractor-like robot with binocular eyes. And she's this, like, smooth, ovular, egg-like mm-hmm. robot that's all white and clean and reflective mm-hmm. And I guess it's your vision of, like, the more female more female robot. I said ovular,
well,
didn't I?
You did. But I definitely knew that I was sort of tapping into some sort of female slanting elements that were fundamental. The other was almost going just off of electronics, in the sense that he was low technology is the way I would put it. And so I thought, let's make her the opposite. Let's make her high technology. He touches the ground. She floats. How he works is very obvious. You can look at him almost like a lawnmower or a motorcycle and kind of figure out how it works. Her, everything's hidden. She's a mystery, like women. And she's got really interesting things going on just under the surface, very subcutaneous. And it's almost like an art object. And I've gotten a lot of people saying, oh, this is... You're making an Apple product, and I can't deny that by today's standards, the most fascinating and gorgeous looking machines to me are Apple products, because they could be art objects without having any function.
Sure, it's like if Brancusi was designing for Apple.
right, and so it was just all these elements put together that just sort of worked for her. I was inspired by I was so enamored by the hardware aspect of binoculars covering for eyes for Wally that I loved going to the other extreme and trying to find another way of doing expressive eyes on a robot through electronics, and having something that was a display on her little black face. And I was kind of inspired by Light Brights. But more high tech, in the sense that you'd have all these little pixelated dots that could sort of reshape the eyes to anything we wanted, which is a much more cartoony way to go. We could squash and stretch these blue eyes and stuff.
I know you love Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. What have you learned as an animator by watching their movies?
The biggest thing we learn is there's almost nothing you can't convey without dialogue. Those guys were the masters of their craft. They had done almost every kind of situation, plot-wise, emotional-wise, relationship-wise, gag-wise, combined. And if you add in Harold Lloyd, you've pretty much covered it all. And that we got lazy as filmmakers when sound came in initially and stopped doing a lot of stuff. And frankly, I think if you were to watch any of the Pixar films and turn the sound down, you'd be surprised at how much you still understand what's going on. Because even though Wally showcases that, we put the same amount of effort in any of our films that the posing and that the action and the timing of everything we do visually is supporting as much as we possibly can the intention of what's going on in the scene.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Andrew Stanton, the writer and director of Pixar's new animated film, WALL-E. It's set in the future, after Earth has become an uninhabitable pile of junk. The only signs of life are WALL-E, a trash compactor robot, and an indestructible cockroach. Wally is very lonely until a robotic probe named Eve is sent to Earth to search for signs of life. Before making Wally, Andrew Stanton directed and co-wrote Finding Nemo and co-wrote Toy Story, A Bug's Life, and Monsters, Inc. Okay, and now for the music question.
Okay, why Hello Dolly, right?
Why Hello Dolly, but let's start with the song. The song, you know, I went into this movie thinking if there's a song that's going to open the film, it'll be, you know, like an original mm-hmm. song, because there's so many Disney kind of films that have mm-hmm. original songs for them. And I heard the song that opened it and didn't realize it was from Hello Dolly. I don't know. I just know like Hello Dolly and mm-hmm. one or two other songs. Didn't know this one. It's actually a really catchy tune. So let's hear it, and then we'll ask why in the world did you choose it? So here it is. And the song is Put On Your Sunday Clothes.
Out there is a world outside of Yonkers, way out there beyond this hick town, Barnaby. There's a slick town, Barnaby. Out there, full of shine and full of sparkle. Close your eyes and see it. Listen, Barnaby. Listen, Barnaby. Put on your Sunday clothes, there's lots of world out there. Get out the brilliantine and dime cigars. We're gonna find adventure in the evening air. Girls in white and a perfume night when the lights are bright as the stars. Put on your Sunday clothes, we're gonna ride through town in one of those new horse-drawn open cars. We'll see the shows at Delmonico's, and we'll close the town in a whirl.
Let's Put On Your Sunday Clothes from Hello Dolly, sung by Michael Crawford, who is famous for his role originating in the original Phantom of the Opera, the original Broadway version of Phantom of the Opera.
That's correct.
So this is from the movie version of Hello Dolly. So why did you decide that instead of commissioning an original song, you were going to open with a song from Hello Dolly?
I was never interested in commissioning an original song. There's a lot of unnecessary baggage and conventions that seem to be put on animation. I've never seen it happen to any other medium where people just feel like, oh, it's animated, therefore it must have all these lists of things. And if there's one thing that I'm very proud of about Pixar is that from Toy Story on, we've been trying to buck any of those trends and break any of those conventions. So I had no interest in doing a musical, I guess, literally. But I loved the idea that Wally was enamored with the past and had a romantic heart or a romantic slant to things. And I loved the idea of opening out on space and having something old-fashioned, something romantic and old-fashioned playing against the image of the real image of space. It didn't need to be embellished. It's how amazingly beautiful in all its natural glory that space is. Because I knew that his world was covered in cloud cover and he could never see the stars as cleanly as we can. So in a weird way, you're opening the movie getting to see his hopes and dreams and hear him before you meet him. And I was just smitten by that notion from the get-go. But an old-fashioned song can be, you know, it's endless what you can choose from. I started listening to a lot of standards. And a lot of standards come from musicals, and I had done just enough musical theater to know some of those standards, you know, Fiddler on the Roof, Guys and Dolls, and Hello Dolly was one of them that I had done. And so it's like taking swatches and putting them against your wall and wondering what color you're going to paint the wall of your house. I was putting music against the beginning of the film again and again and again and just trying anything. And suddenly this song, Put On Your Sunday Clothes, from Hello Dolly comes on, and it starts with this phrase, out there, and it's like, to me, it was like ta-da, and with just hitting with the image of the stars, and I immediately loved it. And I think why it works so well is because the song, in the context of the play Hello Dolly, is about two naive guys that have never left their small town, and they're going to want to go out for one night to the big city and just kiss a girl. And I said, that's my main character. That's Wally. So my co-writer, Jim Reardon, had the idea of, well, Wally could find an old videotape of it then, and that's how he knows it.
So you said you were in a production of Hello, Dolly, what, in high school?
Yeah.
And you were who?
I was Barnaby, yeah.
Which character is that? What did you get to sing?
He's one of the two guys that sing Put On Your Sunday Clothes with the guy. Michael Crawford's character is a character named Cornelius. And it definitely draws from the past.
So you actually sang this song in high school.
Yeah. That's how I knew it. That's how I knew to check it out.
Most of the first half of WALL-E is without dialogue. There's some sound, but it's the sound of what a computer who couldn't really speak might be saying. You worked with the sound designer, Ben Burtt, who did the sound for Star Wars. He did the laser lightsaber, Darth Vader's breathing, the voice of R2-D2. So what did you, and what was the process through which you and he cooked up how the two main robots would sound?
One of the things that I did right from the get-go is I wrote the script exactly like I would write any other script. So when WALL-E was speaking or Eve was speaking or any of the robots, I would give them a line of dialogue in the script. And I would just bracket it to remind myself that I would be replacing this with something else later. But it made me do the homework of exactly what was going on with the thinking and the back and forth that I was supposed to be conveying with whatever they were going to be saying. So when Ben came on, he had this document, just a script that he could actually follow and go, okay, this is what I'm trying to get across. But before he could even get into things like phrasing and sentences and things like that, we had to come up with just what they sounded like. And that took almost a year. It was really a process of him going away for a week or so and just trying a million things. One of the smartest things I did by hiring him was that I got 25 years or 30 years of expertise in this field, of knowledge and also just sounds that he's been storing. And he's just done it so many times. He knew exactly where to start and how to sort of get going right away. So when I would come and meet with him for a couple hours once a week, it would be almost like being at the farmer's market or something. He'd just play me so many things, and I could just sort of cherry pick what I liked. And because I was still in the process of rewriting, I'd have other characters I'd be thinking about that I hadn't told him about, and I would start saying, oh, save that. We'll use that maybe for these bigger garbage bots or this cleaner bot. And we'd start sort of putting these sounds in these buckets until we got to about, after a couple of months, we got to about maybe, I'd say, 30 to 40 sounds per character that I felt defined them, that we felt was their grammar. And he would certainly go off sometimes and refine with notes that I had, like, oh, could we get it a little bit more softer? Or sometimes it was as simple as, I just love that direction. Try more of that. Just whatever inspires you. And then we would spend once I had those, I used those like dialogue. We do a lot of editing early before we actually animate. So we'll have sort of drawings or sketches of what we think the scenes are going to be like on video. And we will put usually the actor's dialogue on there and time it to what we think is right. And then we hand that off for the animator to use the actual models and use the dialogue as a guide. Well, I did the same thing with the robot sound effects. I would put them in and say, okay, this is the line or the sound effect that's supposed to represent, hi, how are you, for example. But as I started to use these defined languages, I wouldn't have sometimes exact takes of what I needed. And then for the last year, I was using Bend exactly like I would deal with an actor. I'd say, okay, I need this line, but now I need it a little bit faster and kind of sounding sad at the end. And he'd run off and re-perform it. So we had, a lot of control over these things and got them exactly the way we wanted, so that when the animator was animating these scenes, they were following those sound effects as faithfully as they would follow a line of dialogue from any actor.
My guest is Andrew Stanton, the writer and director of the new animated film WALL-E. Here's an example of the sound design we were talking about.
10 seconds to self-destruct. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
WALL-E!
So, you know, the humans, the thousands of humans who have been exiled from Earth because Earth can no longer sustain life, have mm-hmm. been orbiting space for 700 years because yeah. Earth just still can't sustain life. Yeah. And they're basically living lives as pointless and empty as Wall-E, the trash compacting robot. I mean, they're sitting in these kind of like lounge chairs that mm-hmm. instead of being on wheels, they just are kind of airlifted around.
Yeah.
And they have, you know, computer screens in front of them in which they're probably watching TV or movies or video games. And they have like those supersized cups of soft mm-hmm. drinks that they're, I assume they're soft drinks that they're drinking.
They're anything
out of.
You want. They're anything kind of food you want in a cup. Yeah.
And everybody is quite obese because all they do is sit and eat and watch the screen.
Yeah, I wasn't really, to be honest, I wasn't really trying to go with some commentary on today, even though I know it completely starts to match headlines. What I honestly had for almost 2 years was humanity were blobs of Jell-O. And they were green with like eyes that were like fruit and Jell-O. And it was so silly, I had to pull back from that because what I was inspired by, I mean, you're absolutely right on the pointless thing. I wanted humanity to have no point to living anymore. Like it was just like all technology had been figured out, you know, survival, longevity, health, food, regenerative food, all that stuff. So what's the point of living? And so it was like this hellacious perpetual vacation. So that was intentional. What I definitely was inspired by was there's a guy named John Hicks who was an advisor to NASA about studying the effects of long-term residency in space. And there's a term they have called disuse atrophy, which is if you're out in zero gravity or in any kind of simulated gravity that isn't matching exactly 24/7 what happens to us on Earth, you slowly lose your bones. You have bone loss and you won't get it back. Which is kind of creepy. And so that's why they're not sending a man to Mars right now for months. And they have to figure this out. And so they've had arguments where if we don't figure this out and simulate gravity correctly, we're going to have people, they'll just be big blobs in space. And I just thought that was hysterical. And so I ran with the idea of let's what if we evolved them so much that we can't even recognize ourselves anymore? We're just like big blobs of Jell-O. But it turned out to be just really silly. And kind of defeated the integrity of where the movie had been up to that point. And so then I pulled back to make them a little bit more familiar to us. And I said, well, then what if nature's just sort of said, okay, there's no reason to grow up. And so I made us big babies. And we studied babies a lot, so the surface of their skin. However, babies are just very cute. They're very appealing and they have very short limbs and their ears aren't fully formed yet. And everything's got this sort of snowy kind of fuzz on the skin and stuff. And so that's what we ran with was big babies. And I thought that was a great metaphor for humanity having to learn to walk again and sort of get to the toddler phase by the end of the movie.
How has your life as an animator been changed by computer-generated graphics? I imagine when you started, you were hand-drawing things.
Yeah, to be honest, most of us still come from an education, at least, of learning how to animate through hand-drawn. And I'm definitely just old enough, just young enough that that was my job when I first worked in the business was doing the traditional style of animation. I had never touched a computer before I came up to Pixar. And that was something that was considered kind of radical for John Lasseter to hire somebody that had never touched a computer. But he was
pretty
smart.
This was what, 1990?
This 1989 when he actually hired me. It was 90 when I finally got up there. And but his radical thinking at the time, which now makes a lot of sense to everybody now because the computer's sort of everywhere, is that you can teach anybody software in 3 months. What I can't teach them is the skills they got to use the computer for. I can't teach them timing and staging and you know, a sense of acting and posing. Those are things he just is good at, and that's why he went to school and all this stuff. And so that's what I'm hiring. And we'll be patient and put up with whatever he doesn't know about a computer. And he was completely right about that. And we've never hired anybody for their computer skills. That's just not part of it. It's just a tool. To be honest, for the one thing John and I have very similar backgrounds on is that neither of us were the greatest draftsmen. We could draw well in our little circles. But when we got to the big time with all the other people that could animate in the business, we were very low on the scale as far as how good we could draw. And when you're hand drawing, your draftsmanship skills really can hold you back from how well you can animate. And to suddenly use the computer where you're more of a puppeteer, I always use the example that it's like you have a virtual puppet with 1,000 strings and you're just pulling the strings. Suddenly I animated, and so did John, just 1,000 times better because I wasn't held back by my drawing skills and I could use exactly the timings and the visuals that I was imagining in my head. So it wasn't something that I was attracted to before I came up to Pixar, but I embraced it fully once I realized that it freed me up like that.
You know, the credits on animated films, including WALL-E, are quite long. And I'm wondering, as director of WALL-E, and you directed Finding Nemo, what does directing mean when it's an animated film? Though it's both in your case. I mean, there's actors in it, and yeah. there's scenes where there's actors, there's scenes where it's purely animation. So yeah. What does it mean to be the director?
It means exactly what it does in live action. I work with, you know, not all those names on there are necessarily people I directly deal with, but I directly deal with almost 250 people by the end of the thing. And again, it's 250 people, not 250 computers that I deal with. And they all have the same jobs that you would expect on a live action crew. I have somebody in charge of props and costumes, building the sets, the lighting, the camera work, all the same things. And I'm having the same discussions with them that you would expect on a live-action set. It's like making a movie in slow motion when you're doing with animation. We don't have the luxury of all getting on the set at the same time, saying action and cut in the same moment, and everybody's work all hits together then, and then you're done. Ours takes weeks per shot or per scene, and we have to meet again and again and have everybody's files that they're doing on their work that they're doing on their computer sort of merge and look at it on a screen in one of our screening rooms. And it never works because it's like playing telephone. And then we go and we get notes and then we repeat it again and again. But the types of discussions we're having and the things we're trying to achieve are exactly the same as a regular movie. And when I talk to animators, I'm having they are basically actors behind the characters. They're shy actors in a weird way. And so I'm telling them about where they're hitting their mark, what scene they're coming from, what scene they're going to, what the intention of the scene is, the exact same dialogue I have with an actor, that whether they're in front of a camera or behind a microphone.
Are there certain movements that are much easier to do with computer animation than they would be if you were animating by hand? Movements for characters.
Well, repetitive things, certainly a lot easier. Linear things that have to move perfectly from one direction to another is much easier. Crowds, when you have to replicate thousands of things or hundreds of things, that's easier. And to get really geeky, part of the process of animating on paper is that you draw one pose, maybe somebody holding a ball, and then you draw the other extreme end of the pose, which is with the ball at its highest point in the air. And somebody usually has to draw everything in between that to give the sense of motion, and we call those in-betweens. Well, the computer can do all those in-betweens for you, which is, can be a very mindless work sometimes. So all the things that you don't enjoy about animating, all the laborious and repetitive aspects, fortunately the computer can do the task for. But all the hard stuff of really coming up with the great poses and the great acting and the great timing, those are still all the efforts and brain work of an artist.
Well, Andrew Stanton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much, Terry. This was a real blast to talk this long about it.
Andrew Stanton wrote and directed the new animated film WALL-E. Instant messaging, texting, and Twittering, are they ruining the English language? Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has his ear to the keypad and gives us this report.
By 1848, the new electric telegraph was already being hailed as a modern marvel that would revolutionize commerce, journalism, and warfare. And in that year, a prominent New York attorney and editor named Conrad Swackhammer wrote an article predicting that it would transform the language as well. Swackhammer noted that the telegraph required its users to be direct and concise. As people got used to sending and receiving telegrams and reading the telegraph dispatches in the newspapers, they'd inevitably cast off the verbosity and complexity of the prevalent English style. The telegraphic style, as Swackhammer called it, would be terse, condensed, and utterly ignorant of synonyms, and it would raise the English language to a new standard of perfection. That was the first time anybody ever used the word telegraphic to describe a style of writing, with the implication that a new communications technology would naturally leave its mark on the language itself. It's an idea that has resurfaced with the appearance of every writing tool from the typewriter to the word processor. And now there's a resurgence of swackhammerism as the keypad is passed to a new generation and commentators ponder the deeper linguistic significance of the codes and shortcuts that have evolved around instant messaging and cell phone texting. The topic got a lot of recent media play with the release of a study on teens and writing sponsored by the College Board and the Pew Research Center. According to the report, more than half of teens say they've sometimes used texting shortcuts in their school writing. The story was a natural for journalists. It combined three themes that have been a staple of feature writing for 150 years. The language is going to hell in a handbasket, you'll never get me up onto one of those newfangled things, and kids today, I'm here to tell you. It wasn't hard to find critics who warned of apocalyptic consequences for the language. James Billington, the Librarian of Congress, said that IM and texting were bringing about the slow destruction of the basic unit of human thought, the sentence. And the enthusiasts of the new media countered with equally momentous predictions. According to Richard Sterling of the National Commission on Writing, IM and texting will naturally erode the conventions of formal writing. Within a few decades, we probably won't be capitalizing the first words of sentences anymore. In response to that prediction, the Boston Globe published an editorial called The Revenge of E.E. Cummings that had no capital letters and was laced with LOLs and texting abbreviations. It had me wondering which is more embarrassing, hearing old people use teenage slang or hearing them make fun of it. I've got a little prediction to make myself. A generation from now, all this stuff is going to sound awfully silly. Did people really imagine that rules of written English sentence structure that go back to the Renaissance would suddenly crumble because teenagers took to texting each other over their cell phones instead of passing notes under their desks in class? In fact, apart from contributing some slang and jargon, new writing technologies rarely have much of an effect on the language. They can give rise to specialized codes, but those tend to run alongside the broad channel of standard English without ever mixing with it. As Conrad Swackhammer predicted, the Victorians developed a breathlessly compressed style for sending telegrams, like the message that Henry James had one of his characters cable in Portrait of a Lady. Tired America, hot weather awful, return England with Nice. But that telegraphic style didn't leave any traces on Victorian prose. When you think of James' own writing, terse and condensed are not exactly the words that come to mind. The linguistic features of the new media are sure to follow the same pattern. Take emoticons. Used sparingly, they can delicately shade the reception of an email. My dean at Berkeley is a master of the deft smiley that turneth away wrath. But it'll be a cold day at the copy desk before you encounter a smiley in the pages of the New York Review of Books. What happens in email stays in email. Kids catch on to this quickly. They may sometimes let texting shortcuts slip into their schoolwork, but they know that there are different rules for formal writing and that you ignore them at your peril. The people at the College Board report that they almost never see students using those shortcuts in their SAT essays. I mean, how dumb would that be? In fact, that Pew study reported that a majority of the kids who use IM and texting don't consider them as real writing at all. And if you think of writing as an intellectual exercise, they're probably right. You're not going to learn a lot about organizing your ideas from punching in text messages against a 160-character limit. But there's another, more basic notion of writing as a process of turning mental activity into automatic manual gestures. And in that sense, the new technologies do make a difference. As the Telegraph first showed, the wonder of modern writing tools is how they can accelerate that process until it seems almost instantaneous. They turn writing into the cognitive equivalent of a Twitch game like Pac-Man or Tetris. The difference is that in the old days, you had to go and engage somebody to tap out your thoughts for you with his index finger. Now we can do that with our own thumbs from wherever we happen to be.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley.